Hi, this is Richard Edelman, and you're listening to The Trust Makers.
Hi, I'm Justin Blake, Executive Director of the Edelman Trust Institute, Edelman's global research center for the study and cultivation of trust. I want to welcome you to a special mini-series of the show where we will be recording from the 2022 annual meeting of the World Economic Forum in Davos. Over the next few days, we will be speaking with key figures and experts about this year's forum and gather their insights on our latest Edelman Trust Barometer special report, The Geopolitical Business. Welcome back to Trustmakers from Davos. Today, we have as our guest, Richard Quest. Richard is CNN's foremost international business correspondent and host of the show, Quest Means Business. Richard has been covering the intersection of international affairs and business for decades, and it's hard to think of Davos without thinking about you, Richard. You are a veteran of these places.
Yeah, I was trying to work out which Davos it is. I think it's 21. So, yeah, 21 of them. I'm one of those people who comes here with a certain, not cynicism, but skepticism. And I've seen over the years the way this place just is hijacked, it's derailed, it's diverted, it's distracted. And you're always left saying, why bother?
Yeah, so here's a question. Has it always been that way?
No. Well, it's fashionable to say Davos isn't as good as it was. And those who've been coming 30 years tell me, even then people said it's not what it was. I think that there is real value in people coming together at the beginning of the year to discuss the major issues. Absolutely. There is real value to see where everybody stands on the core topics of the day, to see what progress there's been, where there's been foot dragging, where what needs to happen. And with that in mind, if Davos didn't exist, you'd have to invent it. Because that's why I think Davos in January is better than Davos in May. You know, because there is real value. However, what has been generated here is like some topsy-turvy, weird world, fantasy land, an orgy of egos and power seekers and greed, which bears no resemblance to what this place was really all about initially. Or indeed, to be fair to WEF, bears no resemblance to what they want it to be.
You say it's not what WEF intended, but if you go back to your first days here, was it still this kind of off-topic distraction, this orgy of egos?
So you have the core program. And my problem with the core program is that it's just become too esoteric. If you look at, well, I haven't got an example here, but I'm sure if you've got the program, you could find something you think, well, a good example is this Davos, where we are now. There really is only one issue. How bad is the situation as a result of the war in Ukraine? Are we going to go into a recession, and what needs to be done? Has there been a failure of consensus values? But instead, Davos will load it up with long-winded panels and four or five people sitting in this Davosian format. And then you've got what I describe as the off-piste. All the events that are going up and down on the promenade, on the Telstrasse, in the hotels. And that's just pure, unadulterated commercialization.
Yeah, so Richard, we're going to go into Ukraine, stakeholder capitalism. Maybe before we do, can you also just maybe take a step back? And for some of our listeners who are less familiar with Davos, you talk about the program, you talk about what goes on outside the right. Congress Center. Can you just paint a little bit of a picture for folks?
Of course. Davos is a small, expensive Swiss ski resort that for a week in January is overtaken by the world's power and money and governmental elite. It is centered around the Congress Center, which is where all the main panels take place. It's where all the big discussions, the keynote speeches. However, throughout the rest of Davos, the town, in the restaurants, in the bars, in the hotels. There is an infestation of corporate largesse. Everybody is taking their little corner, branding it, and trying in some shape or form to do an event. And during the course of the day, you can go to any one of these 10, 15, 20, 30 events that are happening elsewhere. But what I'm seeing now, it's just like the nightclubs, where there's a muscled guy in a black T-shirt standing outside with a red velvet rope. Can you go in? Do you have the right badge? Are you invited? Merely coming to Davos does not get you into the places you might want to get. You have to be in. You have to be cool. You have to be powerful. It's not like it used to be, but there used to be the Google party. And only the cool cats went to the Google party. And if you weren't invited to the Google party, well, why did you bother coming? There was a very famous article written in the FT some years ago about Davos and Davos Man. And it wrote about how there are those people who stay in Davos. Do you get off the train at Davos Platz or Davos Dorf? Do you have to take the shuttle of shame from Klosters? This is all about power. It's all about money.
Yeah.
But you do have the decision makers here. And therefore, the environment is ripe for people to come together to discuss.
Yeah, so let's talk about how they're getting together to discuss some of the important issues of the day. And you mentioned that Ukraine is top of the list. Edelman is coming to Davos with our new trust report, which looks at business and geopolitics. It shows that there's an expectation now for business to get involved in geopolitics, just like there's been an expectation for business to get involved in societal issues. What are you hearing from the business leaders and the Davos men and women that you're speaking to?
Well, this is a difficult one. They don't want to touch it with a 10-foot pole. They know they have to. You see, what we've seen over the last 5 years, 10 years, is the growth of the CEO as the moral barometer. And is the CEO prepared to get their hands dirty? And whether it's the bathroom debate in the United States, the transgender bathroom debate, or whether it's refugees or whatever, CEOs had to make choices. And I've interviewed your boss many times about what are the parameters. The problem with most CEOs, or a lot of CEOs, is they're scared of their own shadow. The really great CEOs are the ones who will take a view.
Yeah.
The really great CEOs are the ones who have been around and can say, no, we're not doing that.
So Richard Edelman loves being on your show here,
yeah.
Which is great. In terms of these CEOs being scared of their shadows, are there things that they're telling you in private that they're unwilling to talk to you about in front of the camera?
This entire place is full of people telling me things that they won't say in front of the camera. The Chatham House rules was invented for Davos. If I had one more conversation with somebody who said, well, look, just between us, or, well, you can't use this, or, well, don't tell us anything. Of course, that's what this place is all about.
My understanding of Chatham House rule is you can say something but not attribute it.
Correct.
If you were to give a kind of like meta information of what people are telling you behind the scenes about Ukraine, CEOs and societal issues, what are you hearing on those topics?
They left. They were pulled out of Russia because they had to. They're pulled out of Ukraine, obviously. Although, no, they're still engaged in Ukraine, except for safety reasons. They are debating about what point they would go back into Russia. One CEO told me recently, he's quite open about it, and he said, look, going back into Russia will not be a commercial decision. It will be a moral decision. I'm guessing he is probably unique. Well, unique, but most CEOs will be looking. You know, look, I'll give you an example of the sort of difficulties we've got. You had, for example, the VW CEO who recently talked about, you know, we need to look at the economy and blah, blah, blah. So it's nuanced. The one comment I hear again and again and again is this is the most difficult time we've ever faced.
As a leader.
Across the board, because the issues are intertwined. They are of a depth and complexity that we can barely contain. And there are things like nuclear missiles also involved, or could be, God forbid. Now, Let's stay with that thought about this is the most difficult time that we've ever faced. Can they do anything about it?
So let me ask you from a different frame. One of the things we really look at this podcast is how to build trust. I wonder what executives are saying that is trust building, because if they're just talking to you off the record, on the side, that might be building some personal trust with you, but maybe in terms of people you've...
What do you mean by building trust?
Yeah, like for your most important stakeholders, whether it be your employees, your customers, investors, like CEOs should be out there talking about some of these issues, not all of these issues, in order to meet the expectations that they do so.
Half the CEOs wouldn't know how to take a principled stand if it got up and bit them. The average tenure of a CEO is, what, 3 years? There are more, and I'm not just here generally, it's a generalization. CEOs are, when I say they're scared of their own shadow, the corporate quarterly reporting requirement has made US and Anglo Euro CEOs so focused on what they're doing now. China doesn't look like that. The CEO in China, but then there's other problems, of course, in China. You know, the government decides that they're going to railroad you, and that's the end of that.
Surely there are some CEOs out there and leaders that are out there. Maybe it's not the most principled stand, but it's important, like a number of companies.
No, we're talking, hang on. Sorry, let me clarify. When I make these generalizations, of course there are many CEOs who are absolutely determined. The true leader, the true CEO is the person who looks you in the face and says, this is what we're going to do and this is the reason we're going to do it.
Can you give an example of a CEO that you've seen do that?
Oh yes, lots of them. Jamie Dimon. He says, this is what we're going to do, and this is why we're going to do it.
So it sounds like with Jamie, one of the things I'm picking up on in what you're saying is, like, there's also a level of integrity, right? Like, in terms of actions matching words.
Yes, completely.
Yeah.
Completely. The Kellogg's CEO, who I interviewed recently, was able to talk quite openly about the worrying aspects of food insecurity. The CEO who says, we're going to do it because it's the right thing to do.
Let's now turn the mirror around. We've been talking about CEOs. Let's talk about journalists.
Sure.
And one of the interesting things we found in the study that we are putting out this week is trust in journalists, which has been quite low, historically low, actually rose 7 points in the last 6 months.
Probably on the back of Ukraine.
Exactly what I was going to ask. Do you think that is purely because of world events?
Yes. Because you're seeing journalists doing what journalists do, which is going into harm's way. While other people are running away from harm, we run towards it. And I get very annoyed when I hear people criticizing journalists or criticizing, you know, they say we're left-wing or we're right-wing or we're this or we're that. Well, how many of your employees, how many of your family are running to do battle? You know, you see Clarissa Ward standing there where the battleground is, with a cameraman and a producer. We have something like, CNN has something like 40, 50 people in Ukraine, and probably more. And the complexity of getting those people in with armored vehicles and the necessary backup and resources and support is phenomenal.
So what can business leaders and other people do to actually support journalists and be helpful to that enterprise? As you talk about, journalists are putting themselves in harm's way. Are there things that business can be doing to...
No, it's not business's job to do that. No, it's not business's job to do that. It's a, you know, we have... We our leaders, the leaders at CNN, the leaders at the New York Times, at the BBC, at Sky, at Fox, require principled leaders to execute in exactly the same way on the basis of integrity. And so you cover the stories that need to be covered in a way that they need to be covered.
And what do you think then is the role of media itself in terms of...
Hang on. It's really easy to take this debate or this discussion and send it down the rabbit hole of social media. All right? That's where everybody wants to go. The disinformation, the getting the information, blah, 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 blah. Now, let's reverse this back, all right? First of all, I'm tired of people saying, well, you can't believe what you read. Well, you can't believe what you see. Well, you can't believe what you... Hang on, what are you looking at? I guarantee you, if you look at the BBC's website, the New York Times' website, Reuters' website, CNN's website, I can give you 20 or 30. You will find out what's happened today in an honest and truthful way. There is no shortage of quality journalism telling you what's happened. But oh no, people have preferred to get it from some Facebook weird group, or they'd prefer to read it on some chat bot, or they'd like to see it on TikTok, and then suddenly say, oh, it must be true. My auntie sent me an article. Oh, for God's sake. So, you go to where the quality is.
Richard, I agree with every word you're emphatically saying, but perceptions. We do surveys of general population. 3/4 are worried about misinformation,
yes.
And that's global. The majority of people think journalists are lying to them.
Yes.
So this is also a perceptual problem.
Yes, but people, where are they getting their information from? Are they going to reputable places? Now, they would say we're not reputable, we're biased, we're this, that, and the other. Well, that's when I get annoyed, because to the person who says, oh, come on, CNN, you're not telling the truth, I guarantee you one thing. There is nothing I can say to that person that will make them change their mind. Nothing. To the person that believes that Joe Biden didn't win the 2020 election, there is nothing I can say that will change their mind. Nothing. Because if I put the evidence before them, they'll say, well, you would say that, wouldn't you?
So is this totally hopeless then?
Yes. No, it's not hopeless. I think you have to go on, a long, arduous effort to show people that there is misinformation, that the quality, but it starts at the top. It starts at the top. And by that, I mean political leaders. And if you've got political leaders, as you have in the United States, just denying the evidence of an election or refusing to confirm the election, then what the hell? If you've got elected officials who refuse to actually make the obvious statement that says this happened and it happened like this, then you're screwed.
So I asked you a minute ago about the role that business leaders can play.
Yeah.
Is there a role they can play in changing this perception at least?
What, about journalism? No.
Yeah. You think business has a stake in people believing truth is truth?
Business? No, because the moment you start going down this road, you're overloading the business agenda. Do what you do best. Run your company with integrity and values. We had a really interesting example in Britain recently, where, I don't know if you're made familiar with it, the CEO of P&O, the ferry company, fired his staff and didn't do any consultation and didn't do any, as was required by law, and didn't do any things that he was required to do, as he was required to by law. And when he was asked by a Commons Select Committee, why not? He says, because we knew the unions would object, so we just decided to do it. Now, he got excoriated and he was roundly criticised. But the point is, he thought it was legitimate to do that. He thought, because in this winner-takes-all mentality. So yes, how can you do it? To answer your question, A, CEOs can make it clear to their employees there's integrity, values and decency. B, it's not profits at all costs. We won't do certain things. And when they make a hard decision, tell the staff, I've made this hard decision for this particular reason. You may not agree with it, but unfortunately, I'm the CEO and I've made this decision and this is why I've done it. Do you know that lovely phrase, reasonable people can disagree?
I remember that. I don't hear that talked about much anymore.
And so I think that's what CEOs do. But they can't. They're too many of them are scared of their own shadow.
But then also, then where do you draw this line in terms of, you talked about like the two core parts of the CEO agenda, but what about social issues, geopolitical issues? How much should that fold in? Well, you talked about values. Certainly anything that ascribes to a company's values, should they go further than that?
Very slippery slope. Very slippery slope. So, for instance, do you take a view on marriage equality? Do you take a view on a woman's right to choose? Do you take a view on capital punishment? Do you take a view on poverty? And you've got to be careful on all of this. Because what happens is you start with the easy stuff, poverty. Well, we're all against poverty. And you start with the healthcare. Well, we're all in favour of good healthcare. And before long, you're on a slippery slope. So you as the CEO has to say, and you have to be prepared to say, I'm not taking a view on this because it's not my business and it's not my business's business.
Has anyone ever said that to you on your show?
No.
That would be a level of transparency that seems like you're seeking from folks.
They dress it up in different ways. We're looking at it. We're thinking about it. We're not sure that this is something we should be taking a view on.
Would you prefer someone just said, you know what, we looked at it and decided this is one we're going to stay out of?
I think you have to go further than that.
Okay.
I think you have to say we've looked at it and this is one that we have to stay away from because there are differing views and we have employees who will be on both sides of it. And this is not a business critical issue that I feel the need to take a corporate decision one way or the other. And you have to be prepared to defend it.
Yeah.
You have to be prepared to say, well, that's why I'm doing it.
So let's focus on a social issue that is near and dear to both of our hearts.
Yeah.
For the last several years here at Davos, you have been the host and moderator of an event thrown by GLAAD around LGBTQ issues related to Davos. Why speak about LGBTQ issues here in Davos?
Oh, it's easy. Because Davos has now given itself the imprimatur of being discussing everything from monetary policy right the way through to water, through to healthcare and every social issue of diversity in between. And the moment you're going to discuss that, LGBTQ is way up there. And Davos, until recently, has singularly, stubbornly, obstinately refused to actually deal with this in a forthright and open way. And there's an argument that says the reason I don't necessarily subscribe to this. There's an argument that says they do it because there's too many countries where same-sex is illegal and cultural, blah, 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 and therefore they don't want to offend. I don't think that's necessarily the truth because they'll offend on other issues here as well. I think that they just, for whatever reason, decided not to bother.
So what's the benefit of talking about these issues here? Like,
why? What's on the agenda?
Talk a little bit more about that, though, right?
Like, okay. The real problem you've got is that the people who are here are all, in most cases, open-minded liberal elites of one. Even if they are conservative, they all have gay friends, they all go to gay dinner parties, they will all tell you, well, of course we're not homophobic. You know, so the people who are here, you're preaching to the converted on many cases. However, get it on the agenda here, raise the flag up a bit, and it suddenly becomes something they can't ignore. I firmly believe, for example, that the number one goal, it's not, in a sense, marriage equality. Marriage equality is the luxury of the developed elite world. Okay? It would be nice to have everywhere, but it's not. The most significant thing is the decriminalization of homosexuality. And from that, you can then go to the next thing of cultural acceptance, which is much more difficult. And I've said to presidents and prime ministers here, and they all say the same thing. Well, we're very conservative and the tribals and the blah, 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 and the people there. And our answer is always the same. That's what leadership's about. That's exactly, and I'll mention names, a former president of Nigeria who was here. And everybody they could not bend over far enough to grovel and to this and that and the other as he walked through. And I said, Mr. President, when are you going to decriminalize? And one of his assistants or one of his aides said, why do you keep asking this, Richard? You know he's in favor. I said, well, why doesn't he do it? I am a man of an age that remembers ACT UP and the whole AIDS crisis of the 80s. And I saw the activism that raised the agenda and saved lives. You cannot make an omelette without breaking eggs. Now, does that mean you embarrass people in public? No. But it means you have to get your hands dirty in this.
Well, I saw you do it yourself 4 or 5 years ago at that GLAAD lunch. You called on the World Economic Forum to do an official session on this topic. And 2 years later, it happened.
Yeah, not a proper one. They still haven't done a major keynote speech by an openly gay, lesbian, LGBTQ person on that issue. They haven't. They still haven't done it. This year, I was 60, all right? I came out when I was, I don't know, 30, 35. I spent the early part of my career terrified that people would find out I was gay. But the reason why, because I could be on a reporter, I could be sent on a story, and a riot, a flood, a hurricane, and there'd only be one hotel bedroom left, and, you know, the cameraman or my producer would say, I'm not sharing a room with that puffer. And I was terrified. I now realize how foolish that was. But now, of course, if they didn't want to share a room with me, I'd say, well, there's the floor. Don't let me stop you. Look at the number of suicides from LGBT. The United States is going backwards. Europe is now the only real beacon, in a sense, where there's not the same, there's not the same moves back. So it is absolutely crucial that we speak up on it now. Absolutely crucial.
And we've talked about business and social issues. We talked about
It's important for business to talk about. This is one issue that business cannot, CEOs must not, because their employees are gay, LGBTQ.
And isn't there a power that Davos Man has?
Yes.
Talk about that power to help on an issue like this. The power of Davos Man to help on this issue.
Davos Man or woman? Yes. It's really simple. Why is Davos Man and woman important here? Because they are the decision makers. The people who are here are the government ministers, the CEOs, the NGO presidents and chiefs. They are the social bloggers. They are the influencers. They are the former CEOs. They are the people who are here. You can love it. You can hate it. You can despise it. But the people who are here are the ones who can make and effect the change. That is a blunt reality of Davos. So if you want to go and stand up on a mountain, or if you want to go and have a demonstration in a city centre, and you want to cry, change, 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 fine, good luck to you. But it's the people who are here who actually can make the change happen. And that's the significance of Davos. And that's why we schlep ourselves up the mountain, pay exorbitant, offensive amounts for hotel rooms that you wouldn't put a dog in sometimes, and listen to long, tedious panels with grandiose statements, because the people you are here with are the ones who can affect change.
Richard, I think you just gave the exclamation point to this conversation. It's always such a pleasure chatting with you. And
good.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to Trustmakers.
Thank you for tuning in to the Trustmakers, an Edelman podcast in partnership with Advertising Week, where we speak with leaders and other trust builders across institutions. See you next time.